May 31st, 2005 Committee on Rules. We have a number of things on the agenda. We will try to move through them as quickly as possible. I see Representative Farr is here, so we'd like to open a public hearing and for House Bills 2999 and House Bill 3151. Representative Farr, why don't you come on forward and bring any guests that you'd like to have. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about these bills, and we are officially in subcommittee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and subcommittee. House Bill 2999 increases from 12 to 16 the maximum number of children allowed to be cared for in a certified family child care home. And House Bill 3151A requires school districts with a certain population of students to provide lunches to students who would be eligible for free or reduced price lunches under federal guidelines.
Great. Welcome. Sorry we're in this room, but we apparently were bumped out for the week, so...
Well, Madam Chair, I want to compliment you on your timeliness.
Thank you.
almost right on time. For the record, I'm Representative Debbie Farr from District 14, and with me I have brought Heidi McGowan. She is with the Oregon Commission on Child Care, and Tom Olson. I actually sponsored this bill on their behalf, and so I brought them along to answer any questions you might have.
Great. Take it away,
Madam Chair. And members of the committee, my name is Heidi McGowan. My address is 1126 Northwest 13th Street, Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm executive officer of the Oregon Commission for Child Care, but I'm here today representing the commission's support for House Bill 2999, and I'll summarize a written testimony from Rosetta Wongren, who is the chair of the Commission for Child Care and is unable to be here today. Just briefly, the Commission for Child Care is a body of 18 volunteers appointed by the Governor and the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate. In order to serve the public, we hold community forums around Oregon, and our last two were in Pendleton in 2004 and Bend in 2005, and in Pendleton, the room was full and overflowing, and we heard great concerns expressed by families facing the challenges of finding child care in the rural area so that they could work. The Commission made access to rural child care a priority for the 2005 session and found the best solution is to increase the numbers of children a certified family home can take from 12 to 16. Therefore, creating a small center without the infrastructure cost and without creating another set of licensing rules, this does not change the rules currently in place. A matter of fact, it will increase supervision for children by a center being able to add an additional staff person. These providers will still be subject to local ordinances and state licensing requirements, which specify a minimum of square footage per child in care and a minimum ratio of staff to children. I'd like to thank you for taking the time, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Ms. McGowan. Mr. Olson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Olson. I'm the administrator of the Child Care Division, and I'm here just as a technical resource.
Okay. Thank you. Short and sweet. That's where we like it. Sarah Shields, any questions? Thanks, both of you, very much. We really appreciate all the work that you do in terms of making child care accessible for Oregonians. We knew it's a huge issue for the state and, in fact, for the country. So appreciate your hard work. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Farr, you stay there. Moving on to 3151, did you want to bring anyone up with you?
Yes, I'm actually inviting Heidi Dupuy from the Oregon Department of Education Nutrition Program.
All right.
But let me just speak to you briefly about House Bill 3151. Kids and families have always been really important to me, and I learned that there were several school districts in Oregon that didn't offer a lunch program. And I was very concerned because one of the districts happens to be close to my house district and recently, within the last few years, had assimilated another district, a much more economically challenged district, into their school district. In the past, that particular district, actually and currently, they do offer a lunch program to some of their students, but not 5 days a week. And so my concern, of course, was that there were kids that were not able to access food. And one out of every three families in Lane County in the last year come from a family who has access to food box. So, you know, that means one out of three kids is probably not eating very much food at home, and they're really depending on the meals that they're able to access at school. So that helped me craft House Bill 3151. There are four school districts that are actually affected by the bill, because the bill only involves school districts of 125 or more students, and we came up with that number because I worked with the Department of Ed, and they really felt that that was about the number where a school district could break even. It also only applies to schools that have 20% or more of their student population qualify for free or reduced lunches. The breakfast option is actually not something that they have to be concerned with, because it is optional based on cost, and for the aforementioned school districts, it would be very difficult for them to make that work financially. But the districts that would be affected are Pleasant Hill, which is in Lane County, Powers, Alsea, and Lowell. And actually, Lowell, which is also in Lane County, has already begun the process of complying with the USDA lunch program on their own, noticing a huge improvement by offering toast and juice to the students that live in that district, and seeing a dramatic reduction in acting out on the playground, and a huge improvement in attention span for the kids that have been affected. So that was really the proof for them. I am here to answer any questions. We have we're able to demonstrate what the cost would be, and we have statistics for the districts that currently are complying with the program.
Great. Thank you.
For the record, I'm Heidi Dupuy with the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm here to...
Sorry, your last name again?
Dupuy.
Dupuy, okay.
And I'm here to answer, provide you with information.
Great. Questions for either of these two?
Yeah, can you go get another committee member so we can vote this out?
I assume someone will be arriving shortly. We appreciate your time and energy. Thank you very much. Representative Bocas, I have you down for 3151. Is that correct?
Yes.
Come on up.
You can stay. I can beat you up. How are you doing? Good. For the record, Madam Chair, I'm representing Brian Bocas. I represent the 23rd House District, which has five rural counties. And as was mentioned, Alsea is one of my school districts. So therefore, I am considered on the House of Representatives floor to be the ogre, so to speak, because I am the single lone vote against this bill over in the House. And to explain that vote is really very simple. Alsea is in between a rock and a hard spot, basically. They're one of the four districts that's in the bill here. They have a volunteer program that they run 3 days a week. There are 166 students in this district. If you take the common school formula and multiply it out, you can do the math. The challenge that they face in Alsea, and we've been unable to overcome, and the district, I believe, is here, and Representative Farr has been working on it too, is the simple fact to get a lunch program into a school that has no serving facility, that's licensed under Benton County, and no kitchen that's licensed under Benton County, means a cost of about $250,000, which is about 25% of the school budget in 1 year. So to get from point A to point B, it's a problem for the school district. I'll let the school district, when it comes up, present its own statistics, but being one of the four districts and at this point still trying to figure out how to pay for it, considering the compression problems in the tax formula, the original options were not very good. The original options for Alsea was close what would be their high school and their middle school, bus those students to Philomath, 22 miles away. And so that's kind of where we're at in the Alsea school district today. And again, it's one of the four that's impacted, and we're still trying to come up with solutions. I'm probably under no disillusionment here of what's going to transpire, but we have a problem in my district, and we don't have a solution. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if I could speak to some of the concerns that the good Representative Bocas raised. One of the important things to note in the bill, and you probably have that before you with the amendments, the bill doesn't take effect until 07. And the school lunch program that the federal government provides does not require the lunch to be hot, nor does it require the lunch to be prepared on site. And there are a variety of other school districts in Oregon that are faced with some of the same constraints that Alsea has: outdated kitchen facilities that no longer meet code, So what they have done and what has worked well for them is to contract out with another school district. Now, Representative Boquist is correct. LC is in a unique situation because they're very isolated, and they're about 20 miles from, I believe, Pleasant Hill or Philomath or what's the next nearest city, Corvallis. But currently, they are offering an alternative program similar to the one that Pleasant Hill is offering. And what I proposed to them was, with this alternative program, they're not getting any federal reimbursement. The federal reimbursement for kids who qualify for free is $2.25. It's $1.86 for those who qualify for reduced, and then 23 cents for kids who pay full price, and the state adds an additional 5 cents per meal. The interesting thing about that is they're doing it 3 days a week and they're not receiving the reimbursement. They can, if they do it 5 days a week, they can receive the reimbursement for all 5 days, and they're meeting the requirement of the bill. And they could offer the alternative program 5 days a week instead of three, or they could contract out those other 2 days. Another creative solution that another school district came up with was, we have a group that's preparing hot meals or preparing meals on these days. They could prepare a meal that same day for the following day. For example, they're doing Monday, they could prepare a cold sandwich. The USDA requirement is very simple. It just it needs to meet the food pyramid guidelines, which is bread, protein, fruit, vegetable, and milk. And it can be very simple. It can be as simple as a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, apple slices, carrot sticks, and milk.
Representative Fowler, the four school districts that are affected, LC,
Ours,
okay.
Pleasant Hill, and Lowell.
Okay.
But actually, as I stated earlier, the Lowell School District is already in the process of complying with the USDA program.
Okay. So, Representative Boquist, do you want to respond to Representative Farr's very articulate statements in response to your concerns?
Well, Madam Chair, I respectfully agree with my good representative. What is issued here is $250,000 to have a county-approved health facility, either as a serving facility or as a cooking facility, one of the two. You can't go into a public school and not meet county health standards. And so that's where we are. This school district never had a kitchen or a serving area or anything along that line. And so we have that challenge that we're still trying to overcome. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
Let me see if I got this right.
Okay. You can contract this out? Can you only contract it to another school?
No. No, you can contract it out to any facility that that meets the state guidelines. So I'm assuming that would be, and Heidi Dupuy from the Department of Ed can confirm this, but I'm assuming it would be a kitchen that met the requirements for food preparation.
Is there a restaurant anywhere in town that would like to do this, that would qualify or anything at all?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, the contracting out of the food, or even, because they're doing it, what LC is doing now is they have a volunteer program 3 days a week. They do three lunches a week, or we put it with volunteers. What is the issue is having either a place to serve it or to cook it. Now, yes, the answer to your question is if you contracted out, or you contracted and brought it in, or you went to a cold lunch program, you can get the cooking portion down. There still is a requirement here. We're in a public body and a public institution. You have to have a place to serve the food, clean it up, so on and so forth like that, and meet the health standards. And LC School District, by the way, is not a modern structure or facility. And so, and the bone of contention, I guess, that we have is we're trying to grappling. I'm not under any illusion of what's going to transpire, but we're going to have to find a solution to LC. And it meets the criteria, as the good representative said. All of the economic problems are in LC, which then means a tax base issue.
Representative Boquist, and I don't mean to make fun of this issue. It's actually kind of nice just to have folks sort of, arguing both sides of a bill and, be able to actually weigh in there and come up with a decision, and so I appreciate you both sort of doing this respectfully. And I guess, Representative Boquist, and just so you know, you're probably not going to be the only one. I know Senator Cruz is just very anxious to testify against this bill, so you will be in very good company. But so, are they not required to meet the requirements for voluntary meals at this point in time? What do they do now?
Madam Chair, basically they're at the threshold. They're doing it 3 days a week, and And they're kind of just doing it.
And just not require, it's just done, like
right.
under the counter sort of stuff. Okay.
Affirmative.
Over the counter. But
under the counter.
However, the bill does allow for school districts to opt out if they are providing an alternative program, but they just have to do it 5 days a week.
Okay. Sarah Shields.
They don't have to participate in the USDA reimbursement.
Got it. Okay. Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're not opposed to the school lunch program. We just have a problem here, and I mean there is no solution. So unfunded mandate, as far as we're concerned, to figure out how to get to this point. So that's our issue here.
I'm just really struggling. It's 2005, my sister's kids went to a single room schoolhouse, and there were four kids. They ranch in Montana, and so obviously this is not only an issue here in Oregon, but I just I'm struggling with all the whatever. So thanks.
Thank you very much.
Anything else, Sarah Shields, maybe?
Well, just it would seem to me that a whole bunch of bright people at the Department of Education and county and health-concerned officials ought to be able to figure out some brilliant strategy without putting this school district over the edge. They really should. I mean, it drives me crazy. You have so many people of goodwill wanting to solve a problem, and because you've got, I understand health concerns. You know, I did a dinner every Wednesday night for 150 people at my church, you know. But we need, this ought to be solvable, unless everybody's just inflexible and being bureaucratic. Excuse me.
The Department of Ed stands poised to help the school districts implement this program, and they'll do whatever it takes. And I have even offered my own time during the interim to help the districts make contacts, and I will do whatever I can to be sure that hungry kids have access to food.
Thank you both very much. Let's see. Mr. Is it Galing?
Yes.
Galing. Del Corsi? Mr. Corsi, why don't you come on up? And Gwen is Gwen Bruno. Let me guess, you folks are all from ALC.
No, I'm from Powell. Tewis.
You're from where?
Powell.
Okay, come on up. Go ahead, whoever wants to start.
Well, I'll start. I'm Bill Galing. I'm the superintendent of schools from Powers, Oregon. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come here and testify before this committee. I have some written testimony as well. And while I understand the desire on the part of Representative Farr for kids to have access to appropriate nutrition, I retain a great deal of concern about this bill, and I'm opposed for the following reasons. Number one, we certainly in Powers have expressed that we have experienced no pressing mandate from the community of Powers to implement an FDA-approved program. Lacking that mandate from the community and understanding that we've set some other priorities financially, I struggle to understand why this particular bill was introduced in the first place. Secondly, the four school districts that are impacted by this legislation, from what I can gather, there was no consultation with those school districts prior to this bill occurring, and I would like to know why. If there are four districts, and everyone knows why there are four districts, why is somebody from ODE not contacting us, or why is Representative Farr or somebody from the Education Committee on the House side not contacting us about impact to the school districts prior to this bill being written and being pushed through the House and then headed to the Senate? Thirdly, if there's an FDA-approved lunch provided. My understanding is under ORS, the ORSs, is that if the district has 25% or greater free and reduced qualified students, we also then have to approve, we also have to provide breakfast. And if that's true, that's going to require more time and staffing. Now, that may not be accurate, but that's, as I read the ORSs, that's what I read from those. That makes it even further difficult for us to comply. I've also had the experience of administering an FDA-approved lunch program in another school district. I am not aware of any district that makes money on its, or even breaks even on its FDA-approved programs when all costs are factored. That's the cost of the facility, maintaining the facility. That's the cost of equipment. That's the cost of staffing that facility. And that, even and maybe most importantly, the cost of record keeping. If you factor all of those costs in, and there are considerable costs, and this FDA-approved programs are fairly onerous in that respect, then I don't think you would get anybody to say that they're going to make $2.30 a lunch or whatever FDA or the federal reimbursement and state reimbursement might happen to be. So that means that the districts are going to be responsible fiscally to pick up the costs. We're not in a position to do that. We've ordered we developed a set of priorities through our school board and our budget board, and lunches are not on the top of those priorities for our funding. We've got old heating facilities and furnaces. We have maintenance issues. We cut programs early in the 2000s. We'd like to add those back. Establishing a lunch program, FDA-approved lunch program, is not at the top of that list of priorities. We have no facilities, we have no equipment, we have no staffing, and we have no supplies to start this program. We have no restaurant that can do this in Powers. We even have to, our market even has to go to Myrtle Point to pick up its bread and pastries because they won't deliver to the community of Powers from Williams Bakery. So we have no one who's going to cater this for us, and certainly we're not going to cater it from Myrtle Point School District at a cost of $2.30 or whatever it might happen to be for the lunches. So if it's going to happen, we're going to have to do it. The school district's going to have to do it because of our geographic location. And I can't see that happening for the amount of money that's involved. We simply don't have, and we're like LC, we don't have the money to put in a facility that would meet the federal regulations to do this. We're very aware of the nutritional needs of our students, and we work with the community to meet those needs. We are a self-contained community, and by that I mean 95% of our kids are within walking distance of the school. So we have a longer lunch period. Those kids can go home if they choose to and eat lunch there. They can bring a sack lunch to school if they choose to do that. If they can go downtown to the restaurant if they choose to do that. If there's a youngster who simply does not have a lunch for some reason or another, and oftentimes it's because that hasn't been provided for them, then we do, through a volunteer program and with using food program materials, we do provide a very basic lunch for those students. So there are no students who go hungry in our school district. We're already providing. We simply don't want an FDA-approved program, or can't see how we're going to implement an FDA-approved program in the community of Powers. So in summary, I'd implore you not to pass the legislation. And while the bill seems well-intentioned, I think it's flawed in content, I think it's flawed in intent, and I think it's flawed in process. And from a small school district such as ours, I think it's very difficult for us to comply. If you have any questions for me, I would be happy to answer those.
Mr. Galen, a couple of questions. How many students in your school district?
145.
145. Okay. And have you planned your budget for the next year?
We've developed our budget for next year, yes.
And what are you basing that in terms of the K-12 number that state school fund?
How much will we get basic school support?
Mm-hmm.
A little over $1 million.
Okay. And you base that on us budgeting at a 5.2 or $5.3 billion?
That was based on 5.2.
Okay.
I'm hoping. I think.
Okay. Senator Shields.
I was just wondering about some of the indirect references you made to demographics and Powers.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody goes hungry. You said. I mean, nobody comes to school and goes hungry.
That's correct.
You do this with a volunteer effort.
That's for very few students. The greatest number of kids either go home for lunch, or they bring a sack lunch from school from home. That's how we meet the needs for the greatest majority of our kids.
Well, with only 145 students, I'm just wondering, have you got 10 or 15 or 20 that would qualify if the program existed? I mean, I know it doesn't exist, but...
You mean free and reduced?
Yeah.
We probably have close to 60% of our kids who qualify for free and reduced. We are remote, rural, and economically depressed.
Okay. 60% of those kids would qualify, but you said there's been no groundswell of support for a program. Is that because they've really never thought about it, never heard of it? You know.
No, there's been a lot of discussion about a lunch program or about lunches in Powers, an awful lot of discussion. And as a matter of fact, at one point in time, when Powers was a larger community, they did have a lunch facility that was torn down when the old high school was torn down. And they elected to meet the needs of their kids in this manner, with them either walking home, bringing lunches to school, or whatever. Well, now, whether it was an FDA-approved program or not, I have no idea.
When did they tear that down?
Oh, that's probably 30, before my time. 30, 35 years ago, 40 years ago, I'm not sure.
I guess I'm just concerned that somewhere in that 60%, there may be some kids who really would improve academically with a nutritional meal that is maybe beyond your ability to provide it with a volunteer system.
Actually, if you want my perspective, I think I've administered an FDA-approved lunch program. I think we'll probably do a better job of meeting our kids' needs right now than we would if we had to incorporate an FDA. Now, that sounds pretty,
all right. I got to move on to Alsay so okay. They get their piece.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Corsi and Ms. Bruno.
I'm Dale Corsi. I'm superintendent of Alsay School District 7J. And this is my business manager, Gwen Bruno. We are here to answer any questions after, with your indulgence. First of all, I'd like to read a statement from my board chair, who I think represents the feeling of the entire town of Alsay and being in opposition to House Bill 3151. So if you will abide with me.
This is from Mr. Lovett. I'm sorry, sir. I'm going to have to ask you to summarize it. It's several pages long. I've got three legislators and a number of folks waiting. So if you could summarize it for me, we would really appreciate it. But all of the committee members have copies of it, and it is part of the official record.
Okay, but I just hope that other people hear what my board chair has to say besides you people reading it. Okay, well, first of all, we are an isolated community. We are on the top of the mountain range, and we are, as you know, 25 miles from Corvallis, 18 or 19 miles from Philomath. We have some of the most wicked curves in the state of Oregon for a stretch up the mountain from there, and it is very difficult to traverse that road if some of you have been over it in the wintertime, especially if it's frosty or icy. And we do have our facilities are same as Powers. We have in the past tried to have a food program and have been curtailed by Benton County Health Department because of the fact that our facilities do not meet the code that is necessary for health standards. They have, however, turned their backs on our volunteer lunch program. We have two ladies that volunteer their food services three times a week, and they provide home-cooked quality meals that are far better than any meal that you could get through a federal lunch program, I'll guarantee you. On the other 2 days that we feed, we do have groups that provide maybe burritos on Monday, or we bring in pizzas from Figaro's or some other place in Corvallis, and we bake them right on site on Fridays. And so our kids get food constantly 5 days a week, regardless of Representative Farr. We also never let a child go hungry. Every child that cannot afford the price of our meals, we are sure that each and every one of them receive a free and reduced lunch. Now, the two ladies that put our program on are non-paid. They do this 3 days a week, year-long, and do this on a volunteer program. We have a lot of our foods coming in voluntary through the gleaners and volunteers throughout the community. If we were to provide the facilities that is necessary for the program as a whole, we would have to completely update our home ec room, which is our kitchen, and we would have to add a lunch room area for the students to sit. As it is, we set a table up outside the door of the home ec room, and the kids file by, and the two ladies feed the students out of the kitchen door.
Sir, does everyone just get fed if they haven't brought a lunch? Is there some criteria? Does it?
Well, any child that comes to school and does not bring a lunch and wants to eat, we feed them. We do have the mercantile downtown. We have an open campus at lunch. Those that want can go down to the mercantile. They have a deli that they can get certain foods. And but no student in our building goes hungry because they can't afford the price of our meals. Now, we have no place that the students eat outside the kitchen door, and then we have to set up some tables up on the stage in order for them to have a place to sit while they eat. So we just do not have any facilities whatsoever to comply with the federal food program.
And your budget for next year is how much?
2.1.
All right. Ms. Bruno, do you have anything you wish to add?
I just want to reiterate what has been said, that the meals currently being cooked are very nutritious, they're wholesome, they're homemade. And the ladies have a way of any student can walk up and buy a lunch, and they very discreetly check off that student. No one knows if that student's receiving free food or if they're paying for it. You know, it's $2 a meal. Those that can't afford the $2 get free food.
And no other student knows it. They're just fed, no questions asked.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, because this is a volunteer system here, it would be pretty hard for us to tell these ladies that you must come in on Monday and Friday as well to provide lunches 5 days a week. And as far as going to Corvallis for cold food, I can't see where that benefits anybody.
And do you know, does either one of you know what the levels of poverty, the number of students that would be eligible?
We used to serve the free milk. It's been several years ago. We had to drop that program because we lost our source for the milk. But at that time, we had more students, and we were only providing milk to 11 students. It wasn't worth the paperwork that we were doing. Okay. Granted, I would imagine that our count may be doubled by this time.
And you have 166 students?
We have 160 students,
okay.
I think, at this time.
All right. Any questions for Alce? Folks from Alce, Senator Ringo.
Madam Chair, it's Alce.
Sorry.
That's okay. I drove through your town on Sunday. It's very nice. And there are lots of curves getting in there and out of there. Madam Chair, I was just going to make a comment. I mean, I'm sympathetic to these people. I think they're doing the best job they can for their kids and their communities. And, you know, I haven't heard the other side of this. I think I know it. It's just, to me, it does seem an example of our state coming in and say, here, we think we know what can be done better in your community than you know. I don't think that always works out that way. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Any questions, Senator Shields? Thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Close the public here. I'm sorry. We've got two senators, one senator, one representative to still testify. Cruz, you almost blew it. Senator Cruz, come on up. Representative Krieger, come on up.
Okay. afternoon. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Rep for District 1, Southern Oregon Coast. This bill kind of reminds me, and that's how it struck me when I learned about it on the morning that we're actually going to hear the bill. I don't serve on that committee. The person who sponsored the bill didn't come and tell me that I actually had a school in that district, and I had no opportunity. And so do you vote against feeding kids any more than you would vote against the speed law we did last year? And we understand where we are with that now, that we had to go back. I probably had as many calls on that as any other bill I had all year. I think it's important to realize that these small districts have coped over the last 10 to 15 years as they've had declining enrollment and the economy in lots of parts of rural Oregon, where they've finally found a way to accommodate the need of the kids in the schools, and they, in fact, are feeding those kids. It would seem to me that it actually comes down to an issue of local control. They're finding a mechanism to do it. I don't think the state has to come in. Had I had time to work the bill or understand the bill and then contacted ahead of time, it would have been a lot better, but there wasn't a person in there other than that served on that committee that was familiar with what was taking place. It was one of those things at 8:30 you hear the bill in a caucus that is coming up, and at 10:30 we're on the floor and attempting to get a hold of my superintendent, Mr. Gilling. I wasn't able to get him during that two-hour period. Hey, have you read the bill? They hadn't seen it coming either until it was voted on. I would not vote for that bill today. I would have argued the point on the House floor after learning what I did and the number of complaints that I got from the Powers District and the parents. And some of these parents are the parents of the children who are receiving the bills. They're perfectly willing.
That's my other question.
I also note that there's two ways that the schools can opt out. And I would suggest that probably, because one of them I believe is a financial reason that they can opt out, probably most of them could do that. But I'd ask that you don't move the bill. Local control is important. They've got a mechanism for taking care of the kids, and there's no evidence to show that there's anybody that's not being fed.
Thank you. Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, District 1. It's interesting, Senator Ringo said he drove through LC. You don't drive three powers, you drive two powers. And I would say the curves on the road to powers would challenge the curves on the road to anywhere. It's a very isolated, very self-contained community. And I mean, it's interesting, of all the candidate forums we had, probably more people show up at Powers than any place. We have a candidates forum, there'll be 50 to 80 people show up. I mean, the community is involved, and they're involved in their school and every aspect of the community. They have come up with solutions to deal with their issues. You got to understand, these are economically depressed areas. Senator Deckard in the Senate Revenue Committee today was discussing an interim plan to look at the funding formula and what we have done for or maybe two small schools in the formula. And clearly, from my perspective, they have not been treated fairly in the formula. But that's my perspective because I have a lot of small schools.
And Senator Cruz, my understanding that LC is at $2.1 million for 160 students, whereas Powers has $1 million for 145 students. And so I don't know if there's some distinction in those numbers, but okay, we're going to get some help here.
Yeah.
Come on up, Mr. Galing.
$1.1 million is a basic school support. That's not a total budget.
Okay. Got it. Okay. All right. Because I was concerned about the inequities there. So, okay.
But having said that, Madam Chair, and I'm sure there was a lot of interest in the formula this time, and I think it's prudent that we put it to the interim to do a full study of it. But what we are contemplating here is, to a large degree, an unfunded mandate. Now, it is right that schools can choose to opt out and they can jump through some bureaucratic hoops. I guess, Madam Chair, from my perspective, we have two communities that have testified here today. very unique situations that have found ways to deal with their kids and make sure their kids are adequately taken care of, and I question the state coming in and putting additional requirements, additional mandates on top of that. This is a local control issue, and we talk all the time about all the mandates that we place on schools. On the academic side, there are other mandates we place on schools. I'm afraid this is one of them. Representative Farr said that Lowell School District is on their own already complying. So clearly it's a matter of the self-interest of the school to do what is best for themselves as far as their economic situation and for their students. If Lowell has found a way to do that, good for them. The other school is Pleasant Hill. That's even closer to Eugene. The road between Pleasant Hill and Eugene is a very good road. So their connectivity is certainly at a higher level than either Alcee or Powers. So Madam Chair, this is a very well-intentioned bill. I just am fearful for the negative repercussions it's going to have on four school districts in the state. We're legislating four school districts in the state, and that just seems inherently wrong to me.
Well, Senator Cruz, I remember a bill we passed last session to split Ione off from Heppner so Ione School District could survive. So we have done it before.
Madam Chair, I'm not disputing that, and we're nothing if not inconsistent in this building. I understand that. But from the perspective of Representative Krieger and myself, one of these four is in our district, and it is our feeling, as well as the feeling of, I believe, the superintendent and the community, that this is not in their best interest.
Thank you both very much. We are going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2999 and House Bill 3151. It's not the chair's intention to move either of those bills today. We'll ponder both of them. Appreciate both sides of the issue coming forward, and I certainly understand that everyone has the same goal in mind, and that's making sure that when our children come to school or at school, they're well fed. I didn't want to ask any of the rural school districts whether you had pop machines on campus. Mm-hmm. That, fortunately, issue is not in front of our committee today. So thank you very much. Chair opens the committee hearing, public hearing on Senate Bill 1054, and invites the Senate President forward. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Briefly, Senate Bill 1054 modifies the composition of the Legislative Emergency Board. There is one amendment before the committee. That's the -1 amendment. The amendment would add two House positions and three Senate positions to the Emergency Board for a total of 22 members, 11 from the House and 11 from the Senate.
Thank you. Mr. President, Ms. Garrett, Mr. Garrett, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Brown, and members of the Senate Rules Committee, Vice Chair Crioli, Senator Shields, and I know just a few moments ago, Senator Atkinson and Senator Ringo were also here.
Senator Atkinson is not feeling well. He's here in spirit, Mr. President.
As well as High and Learned Committee Administrator Harris. I'm Peter Courtney. And I live at 2925 Island View Drive North in Salem. I'm a state senator from District 11, which includes portions of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. Thank you for allowing me to come here today and testify in support of Senate Bill 1054, which would change the structure of the board as we know it. Currently, the emergency board consists of 17 members by statute. 9 of those members come from the House, and 8 of those members come from the Senate. The House Speaker and the Ways and Means Chair on the House side, plus 7 House members, make up the 9 members of the House. The Senate President and the Ways and Means Chair, plus 6 members of the Senate, make up the 8 members of the Senate. If my recollection serves me correctly, that's why I have my high and learned counsel, Chris Garrett, with me. Of the members in the Senate, at least 3 of the state senators have to have prior or previous Ways and Means experience, and at least 4 of the members on the House side have to have Ways and Means experience. That's spelled out in statute. Senate Bill 54, with the proposed dash one amendments, would add two House positions and three Senate positions, making a total of 22 members, 11 from the House and 11 from the Senate. Not many people understand how the E-Board ever came into being, how it evolved. It was created by statute in 1913. Interestingly enough, my fellow senators, its composition then was very different. It had seven members, including the governor, the secretary of the state, the treasurer, the president of the Senate, the speaker of the House, and the two chairs of the two Ways and Means Committees. So interestingly enough, it consisted of seven members, but three of them were statewide office holders. Thus, the E-Board originally had four legislators, two from each chambers. So the statute that created the E-Board was equal. Four, two from the House, two from the Senate. The reason they got to seven were the statewide office holders. In 1931, the legislature changed the makeup of the E-Board and replaced the three executive branch members with the legislative members. The E-Board then had a total of seven members, all from the legislative branch. That appears, historians, that appears to be when the House and Senate delegations were thrown out of balance. Again, that appears when it happened in 1931, favoring the House, four members to three members from the Senate. By 1952, the legal status of the E-Board was called into question. Which, interestingly enough, should interest at least one member of this panel in particular. In response, the voters in 1952 enshrined the powers of the E-Board in the state constitution. The neighboring legislation in 1953 provided the E-Board would have nine members, the Senate President and the House Speaker, the two Ways and Means Chairs, two other members of the Senate, and three other members of the House. Thus, the imbalance of the House and the Senate membership continued. In 1973, the legislature added six positions to the E-Board for a total of 15 members, seven from the Senate and eight from the House. In 1979, two more positions were added, again, one from each chamber. And thus today, the E-Board by statute has 17 positions. There are eight from the Senate and there are nine from the House. This is a brief little study of history about the evolution of what we call the E-Board. This proposal. The expansion of the E-Board is a logical and necessary consequence of the fact that the state budget process and the need for interim legislative action have grown over time, yet the legislature meets only biannually. In Senate Bill 1054, I propose to increase the number of the E-Board members to equalize the membership of the House and the Senate. Doesn't read right. The original bill would increase the membership to 20. I have proposed a dash one amendment that would push the total to 22 with 11 from each chamber. This expansion would, number one, facilitate the work of the E-Board, ease the workload on individual legislators, allow for more diversity of membership, and allow the appointment of more members with Ways and Means experience. As the responsibilities of the E-Board grow, we must assure that it is as representative as possible. Number two, it would allow the E-Board to include as many legislators as currently sit on the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Presently, the Joint Ways and Means Committee has 20 members of the legislature, 10 in the House and 10 in the Senate, plus the Speaker and the Senate. Therefore, you'd add the Speaker and the Senate President to the E-Board. This would correct the historic imbalance of membership. I am unaware of any legislative reason for the imbalance. The Senate and the House both represent the same number of Oregonians. The Joint Ways and Means Committee has had equal membership since at least 1913, the year the E-Board was created. The E-Board should function the same way. Senate Bill 1054 would give the legislative leaders more flexibility in appointing delegations that reflect the party's representation in their chambers. For example, the Senate is split 18 to 12. The Senate currently has eight positions on E-Board. Leadership cannot appoint an eight-member E-Board delegation that corresponds to the 18-12 split. Neither 4-4, nor 5-3, nor 6-2 are the same ratio as 18-12. Senate Bill 1054 wouldn't guarantee perfect proportionality, but it would let us get closer. That is the proposal in this legislation. That is a feeble attempt to tell you the history of how the e-board evolved. It is also an attempt to try to analyze the joint ways and means process in terms of its makeup, going back to the year 1913. Thank you, Chair Brown.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Farioli, questions?
Actually, Madam Chair, the proportionality question was just dealt with. So I appreciate the opportunity to ask, but I think Senator Burton covered that question.
Senator Shields, any thoughts?
No, very fine. Thank you.
I think it's really interesting, Mr. President, as you're talking that essentially you're creating an e-board that is extremely reflective of the Ways and Means Committee, number one. And number two, you're creating an e-board that's one-third of the body, and the entire body. And I think there's some symmetry to that. One-third of the House, not quite one-third of the body, but pretty close.
Chair Brown, members of the Senate Rules Committee, yes, it's exactly right. And I was taken by the remarks some years ago made by a certain state senator who was then a state rep, that given the number of legislators there are, 90, and given the fact we meet only every 2 years, and this whole budget process is handled by this sort of small little world, I sought to increase it for that reason, too. And the one-third was driven in part by that, to be very frank. It's allow more legislators an opportunity to serve in this mini-legislature, if I may call it that, during the 18 months in which we're not in session dealing with budgetary matters. Also, to match it directly to the numbers we now have on the Joint Ways and Means Committee. The other two are simply the President and the Speaker, which you would do because that's historically what we've done. I tried not to serve on the e-board last session, for what it's worth, members, if you may be interested, and they ordered a legislative council opinion ordering me to serve on it.
Everyone else there. Okay. All right. Any other questions?
A couple questions.
Sure. Senator
Farioli. If we'd be moving in the proposal to the same number of people who are currently serving in the Ways and Means process, why not just turn the duties of the Legislative Emergency Board over to the folks in Ways and Means?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, I can't respond to that except for some reason historically, for example, let me just give you an example. You go back to 1913 when it was created in terms of our research. The President and the Speaker have always been on it. That's the historic significance, and I think it's because they're the presiding officers, and so the presiding officers are deemed necessary to be on it during the interim because they're presiding officers. I don't know. We didn't get into the logic. It's just that when it was created in 1913, they were absolutely put on it, for example, if I may say so, Senator Farioli.
Mr. President, I guess just sort of my observations in terms of watching this last interim when we had the tied Senate. It seems to me, given the dynamics of how issues move through the building, et cetera, I think it's a really, I wasn't sure that it was a critical component to have your presiding officers on the e-board. After watching last interim, I think it's absolutely critical to have your presiding officers be on e-board, given the nature of the issues that are being dealt with, given their critical importance in terms of their functioning in the building and this institution. I think it would be pretty hard. I mean, I'm not opposed to your suggestion. I just think you need a connection between how the institution functions and the presiding officers can provide that during the interim. That's just my only thought on that, Sarah Farioli.
And, Madam Chair, thanks, except just for the point of clarification, just a question. I was wondering if you're looking at the structure and you've got a parallel structure with the exception of two members, wouldn't it be easier maybe to replace the two members and then move forward with the same structure? But it seems just a coincidence that there are the same numbers of people there, and that's all. Mr. President, there is certainly, you could take 22 members and divide by 2 and come up with 11 for each chamber. That's certainly what I see here, and that's logical. But there are 60 House members and 30 senators. And even though we do represent the same exact number of persons per district,
and that all of us in aggregate represent every Oregonian. We're, after all, statewide elected officials, even though we serve from a district and are elected from a district. By what logic could you prevail on the members of the House that they should have equal numbers on a body like this when they have twice as many members in their deliberative body?
Chair Brown, Senator Farrelly, first of all, in 1913, when it was created, it was 2-2. It was totally equal. It was a 7-person board. As you know, the other three were the governor, the secretary of state, and the state treasurer. That's how it was 7 back when they created this thing. Then when those three were removed and they went to a 7-person, they then put on more House members than Senate members. That's how it evolved. So now take a look at your Ways and Means Committee. If you look at your Ways and Means Committee, from the history that we've done going back to 1913, they've always had an equal number of House and Senate members on the joint Ways and Community meeting. There's always been the same. Now, I could be wrong here about joint committees in general, Senator Farrelly, and members of the Rules Committee. But many of those joint committees that I've served on in the legislature, I thought were fairly representative in terms of being equal, but I could be wrong on that, so I may get myself in trouble on that. It's just that the ways and means process has always been very equal. It's been equal. We don't, because the House has 60 and we have 30, give them more members on the joint Ways and Means Committee. The E-Board is a joint committee. It is a joint committee. And from a historical perspective, plus as well as an ongoing perspective, that is why I feel that it would be appropriate to do 11 and 11. Not to mention the fact, and it may not prevail on the House, to be very frank with you. I may not even prevail on you. It's got to get out of the committee. But I do think there's some historic significance. It was always equal up until a certain point. And as best we can know, back to 1917 or 13, that was our research has taken us back that far on the Ways and Means Committee. There's always been an equal number on the House and Senate on the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Any further questions?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 1054? With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1054. I believe our amendments will be arriving shortly.
Momentarily.
Somebody's running them up from LC, as opposed to LC. LC.
Real cute.
Well,
you can dish it out, can't you?
Yeah.
Can't take.
I was going to say she's getting into my arena there, you know.
I can't imagine I would ever be so funny as you, Senator Shields. 3017. We lost both our. Lost Dave Hendricks. If Dave Hendricks and Dave Henderson in the building, we'd love to have the two of you troop up, and we'll head up and we'll hear the bill as soon as the both of you come up. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3017. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 3017 delays the commencement of a 6-month disqualification period for public contractors who fail to pay wages or costs of materials associated with public contracts.
Mr. Blackfoot, I assume you're the proponent. Come on up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jared Broadfoot here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association in support of House Bill 3017. Real simple fix for this bill. It's on actually lines 22 and 23 and then repeated again. Trying to find, there's another place in the bill, or I believe it's on the back where it's repeated. What we're doing, let me explain the situation to you. When someone calls the Construction Contractors Board to file a complaint about non-payment for labor or materials, they begin an investigation. Currently, what the law says that the period of debarment, which is not less than 6 months in any case, begins the day they receive the complaint. So if it takes them 6 months to to do an investigation, and the penalty is debarment for 6 months, the person has already served that period of time without actually having served it at all. So this just clarifies of when the, if you're found guilty, when the penalty phase starts, not when you receive the complaint, because it may take them 6 months, a year, however long it takes them to do their investigation. It actually that gives them the ability to say it starts upon completion of the investigation. So we had no opposition to the bill up to this point, and we're just trying to fix that. Actually, it was something was pointed out by CCB to us during the interim. We wanted to come in and fix it. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Bradford. Any questions?
Just a clarifying question for the record. Is a contractor who's subject to one of these investigations automatically excluded from public contracts during the time that the board is deliberating and investigating a complaint?
No, they're not automatically disbarred. We've checked with CCB, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and they don't automatically put someone on there during that period of the investigation.
All right, it's only after there's been a finding.
Yeah, only after there's been a finding. You're not automatically put on the bad list when the investigation's opened up.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3017? Close public hearing, open public hearing on Senate Bill 1062. Mr. Hendricks, Mr. Henderson, Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1062 requires members of the Legislative Assembly and certain staff to retain records containing information related to the public's business for 1 year after the records are created. The bill also provides that members can deliver subject records at any time during the legislative session, and it allows the Legislative Administrative Committee to adopt certain exceptions to the retention requirements. Mr. Hendricks, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. Committee Administrator has explained the basic proposal here. In looking at the public records law, which does apply to records held kept by members, it came to our attention that there is currently no retention period specified by law for how long you need to keep records. And the purpose of this bill was to establish a one-year period of retention. It would apply to members' individual records, to records of legislative assistants, caucus employees, and other persons employed to assist our legislators in the conduct of the public's business. You should have before you a set of -1 amendments. The principal purpose of the -1 amendments would be to make it clear how this new statute would interact with the current statute we have with respect to retention of so-called legislative records that's found in Chapter 171. Those statutes apply to records of the Legislative Assembly, a committee, and we have clarified here, or to a committee employee. We wanted to make it clear that those rules that are laid out in that section, which may provide for much longer retention periods, do not apply to that. Those continue to work on the way they always have. This new retention period would apply only to these people that I have just mentioned with respect to retention of their records. That's all I have. If there's anything I can, any questions, I'd be happy to try to respond.
Questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I just need to get my brain on this a little better. You said right now there is no time period specified. We are obligated to retain records, correct? So,
Chair Ferriero, Senator Ringo, that's correct, because the public records law would not have much meaning if there was no requirement that records be recapped.
So what is the law right now, then? You retain it a reasonable period? Is it a reasonable unspecified period?
Chair Ferriero, Senator Ringo, it is really unclear to me. There is no law that really dictates how long to keep them. Our concern is that there's a criminal provision that makes it a crime to destroy a public record, except as allowed by law. And so that was our concern, that we should go in and establish what that period is for members, since they had kind of fallen through a crack, apparently, in previous statutes as far as what those rules would be for members of the members' records.
And I'm looking at this for some guidance on what is the definition of a record.
Senator Ringo, that is essentially the definition that comes from the public records law. Information relating to the conduct of the public's business is the definition used in the public records law applicable to members of the Legislative Assembly.
So would this include an email I received from somebody?
Senator Ringo, yes, it would. As you remember, there was a lot of discussion with respect to how much of that you needed to keep, and you should have a copy of a memo that I prepared that explained the ability to make decisions as those things come in.
And I was going to recycle that memo, but then I thought it's a public record and I can't do it.
You can make a decision as correspondence comes in from members of the public about whether you're going to use and retain that record. That's always been part of the public records law, and it's our opinion that if you decide not to use or retain a communication that comes in, you are able to delete that or destroy that communication because you've just decided this isn't of interest to me, I'm not going to use it in doing my business.
I see. And how do we get to the one-year period?
Okay.
Why 1 year?
Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, that was a policy decision that was made by the folks directing the drafting of the bill. It's kind of unique records here to some degree. There are a lot of retention periods that are specified for public agencies by the state archivists and their rules. They range from 1 year up to forever for certain things.
And it's 1 year.
Mr. Hendricks, if I can let you off the hook on this one, I think this was a decision reached by leadership in the Senate, the Democratic leadership in the Senate, that based on practicalities, i.e., like it would be impractical to ask Senate members to retain bill files for a period of 4 years or 10 years or whatever. Where would you keep them? How would they be filed? Who would do the organizing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think what we felt was this time period was pretty realistic. Folks could come in, leave here from session, keep the bill files intact, which normally happens, and then at the beginning of next session, simply recycle the contents of those file folders and leave it at that. I think it was just a practical way of simplifying. So.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Senator Ferrioli.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the clarification that it was the Democratic leadership of the Senate. The
Democratic majority leadership of the Senate.
So let me, if I may, Madam Chair, I think along the lines that Senator Ringo opened up, I thought that was very insightful. A public record, other than a personal correspondence, please differentiate, please. What is personal correspondence as opposed to the kind of material that flows cascades daily across a legislator's desk?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, I think there's always going to be very clear examples of what private communications are going to be. Letters from family members and other things not relating to the public business, clearly it's private communications. Spam that comes in, clearly that does not relate to the conduct of the public business. That's the key thing here. Does it relate to the conduct of the public business? If it slips over into that point where it is discussing or advocating with respect to legislation and you decide to keep and use it, at that point it is public record.
Madam Chair, if I choose to write everything in my own hand, is that personal correspondence?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, do you mean the fact that it's in handwriting?
Yes.
It makes no difference the form in which the record is made.
And I assume that would be true of information coming to the legislature.
That is correct. And I will say, too, that generally, because of the way the public records law is written, almost everything that members of this body write, either to staff members or to other people outside this building, are probably protected from disclosure under the public records law. It's the way that statute was written on the public records when they made it clear that that law applied to members of the Legislative Assembly. They added in this little exception that said that to the extent the material would be covered by the speech and debate clause in the Constitution, that you would not be a public record. Well, we have interpreted that to mean almost everything that members, other states have interpreted that as well, that speech and debate clause, so that things that you say or send out are probably exempt from disclosure. So what we're really talking about here is communications coming in from outside and retained and used with respect to your business.
So let me see if I can understand the complexity here. If I write a memo to a staff member relating to the conduct of a debate or a proposed action, my correspondence out is probably not discoverable or subject to the open or the disclosure law.
Probably for a couple of different reasons, not just because of the speech and debate clause, but because of another exception of the public records law relating to internal communications. That, and hence the letter back from the staff person may very well be exempt as well.
Okay.
Well, I think that causes a rub. My correspondence out to my staff person may not be subject to the records retention law and may not be subject to disclosure. But since my staff member is receiving something in, it would be discoverable and disclosable.
Seth, if you could not use the word discoverable, it throws the lawyers in the room off.
You know what? That's not my problem.
Senator Perioli, the important thing here is to remember the difference. There are a lot of things that are public records that do not need to be disclosed. But because they're still public records, they still have to be retained. And so they have to be retained for a year, but when it comes time when someone says, I want to see that, at that point you need to look at all those exceptions that are out there, and you may very well find this is something I don't need to disclose, for instance, internal communications. So to the extent they are public records, and most of these things we're talking about are, they may be exempt from disclosure, they still need to be kept. And the reason being that at some point a court may need to decide whether or not, in fact, it's subject to disclosure or not. You can't say, well, I think this is exempt under the public records law from disclosure, and even though it's a public record, I'm going to throw it out. You still need to keep it because at some point that decision may have to be made by some other authority.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
Would memorandums between lobbyists and legislators fall into the retention cycle? Would that be retainable?
The memos that come from a lobbyist to the legislator, if they relate to the conduct of public business, and if you use them and retain them, retain and use is the words that the public records law talks about, They are public records, and you would need to look to some other exception if you wanted to argue that it was not subject to disclosure.
Can I ask a hypothetical?
Of course you can.
One of the routine practices for lobbyists is to try to communicate with legislators during legislative sessions, and they routinely write a little note, and the legislator acts on that note. And often it results in a meeting in the hallway or in the foyer in front of the chamber. Is that action and reaction, does that constitute taking action on a piece of legislation pending because the request was, please come see me on such and such a bill. The legislator acts on that by accepting that meeting. Would that note to the legislator be a retainable document?
Senator Farioli, I kind of think not. And the reason I say that is because the note that you're receiving isn't really, it isn't telling you anything about the proposal. It's just saying I'd like to meet you outside. And I'm just not sure how you could argue that's being used in the conduct of the public business. I'm not sure it's kind of see the pants here. I'm not sure I would say that was a something that needs to be retained.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
If
the note requested the one of the caucus leaders to do a vote count on a bill, and the caucus leader did that vote count in the conduct of the business. Mm-hmm.
I want to think about this a little bit. My gut reaction is if you act on it, if you actually use it and act on it, that is something. I'd want to think about that one a little bit, Senator.
Madam Chair, the point of illustration is that if I received an email from a constituent that was compelling to me, and that it convinced me that there was an argument for or against a measure, then I'd be required to keep that correspondence. If I read the correspondence and I found it not to be compulsive or not to be insightful or informative, then I could make the decision that it wasn't retained.
Senator Ferrioli, the important thing here is whether you intend to use it or not. Our opinion is the fact that you read it is not significant, or even if you see something in it that you think is interesting. The question is are you going to use this correspondence? For instance, one of the things we're concerned about is if you get up on the floor and say, my emails are running 10 to 1 against this proposal. At that point, it seems to me you've used it because you're saying, you know, I'm making an argument about based on these things. It's another thing just simply to read it and say, okay, I know what you're saying, but I'm not going to use it or retain it. The question is, are you using it in some way as far as you think?
Oh, Madam Chair.
So
if you quoted on the floor, my email is running 10 to 1 against this proposal, you better have 10 emails in your file. And or at least 11.
We feel that would be wise to retain your emails if you're going to use those in that fashion.
The illustration here, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate this, we could do hypothetical all week and never cover the questions that will occur on a routine basis to every single legislator in this process and all of their staff members and all of the other folks who work in this process as committee administrators. What's the penalty for failure to retain?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, there is a criminal penalty, and I believe it's a Class A misdemeanor.
Perfect. Madam Chairman, I suggest we all brush up on what it will take to have the legal counsel, the legislative counsel, be prepared to represent virtually everybody who works in this process, because I believe that you're going to get lots of questions. You're going to be requested to respond. If you guess wrong, you're going to be ending up defending staff members, committee administrators, legislators, and a whole host of other folks.
I assume the district attorneys are charged with enforcing this particular Class A misdemeanor. My guess is, Senator Ferrioli, with all due respect, with the workload they have, they do some amount of prioritizing. That my guess is they're not in looking for legislators to prosecute for failure to keep lobbyist notes in a file. But I could be wrong.
Madam Chairman, do you feel that the district attorneys feel that they're adequately funded in this process?
No.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting leverage.
So, Brown, the other thing I would say is that that particular aspect, of course, pre-exists this bill. That the problem of retention of records is already there. The problem that the bill addresses is
trying to clarify.
It doesn't say how long you do need to keep them. The requirement that you keep them is implicit in the Public Records Act already. So
So there is a certain policy conversation in South Carolina. You and I have had this conversation about, you know, exempting the legislature from the Public Records Retention Act requirements altogether. We have chosen not to make that move, but I think it's, you know, certainly in terms of a relating clause, et cetera, that policy discussion is available to you on the Senate floor should you choose to go that route.
Madam Chairman, I'll anticipate the issue and make the argument here. Madam Chairman, I believe that the requirement for us to conduct our business in public is in full operation. That's why we have people listening on the Internet. That's why we have the committee structure the way it is. That's why we do public recordings and transcriptive recordings. We hold our deliberations in public. The dispository actions that we take are all a matter of public record. But it's my contention, Madam Chair, that we also have the option of exempting legislators from the requirement of keeping voluminous files under the retention requirements, which may or may never be requested by the public. It's expensive. It certainly isn't certain whether or not documents that are retained are ever going to be discovered or shared or made public, because each and every one of those documents that are retained are going to have to be subjected to the scrutiny of legal counsel for the applicability of the retention law. The other issue, Madam Chair, is that by opening this new venue and creating a retention period, you're simply inviting people to make requests, and they will. And we will be making the discriminations about which records to retain and which that are unnecessary to retain. And inevitably, we will make the wrong judgments, whether those are informed by counsel or whether those are just the judgments of members and committee staffers.
But that's current. I mean, we're required to retain records now. So I think the goal of this bill is to clarify both what and for how long.
Madam Chairman, I understand the thrust of this legislation. I simply wish to offer an alternative, that the alternative should be considered, at least, that legislators in the performance of their duties are exempt from the retention requirements.
Thanks.
And that those requirements for public disclosure, where dispository actions are taken, where votes are taken, where public debates are held, those are in place. And so it's right now at the federal level, non-dispository documents are not public records, and they don't become public records unless and until they were used in making the decision. And they're not subject to the disclosures laws in the same way that the state would be making these subject to disclosure. So it would seem to me that there's a way of getting at the issue of full public participation and disclosure. And we do that with our committee's process and with the debate process and with the floor sessions that we currently have and with the records retention requirements that we have for our committee staff. It doesn't seem necessary to me to make legislators and staff members retain potentially volumes of information for a year on the off chance that it might be discovered or it might be subject to the disclosure laws at some future time. We've had this discussion before.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the impulse toward making every scrap of paper, every piece of correspondence a matter of public record. Maybe that is a laudable impulse, but in practice it's very impractical and expensive, time-consuming, and loaded with the potential for making an error that would subject staff persons, legislators, and innocent bystanders, in effect, to criminal prosecution. It seems rather unnecessary to me. So I was hoping, and I am hoping, that we can approach this issue in a much more creative way that doesn't hamstring the institution, yet still provides the kind of public records people need to determine how an issue was debated and acted upon and enacted, without having the blizzard of retention records that I think we're going to end up saddling future legislators and legislatures with. So, Madam Chairman, I don't think much of this proposal.
Thank you, Senator Farrielli. Okay. We welcome your furthering the policy discussion by having a minority report on this issue on the Senate floor. Senator Shields, any comments?
Yeah, I guess a question. Are we actually putting ourselves in a position where we would have to keep more records than, say, a member of Congress and their staff?
Chair Brown, Senator Shields, I don't pretend to be an expert on the application of the Freedom of Information Act at the federal level. We could look into that for you, but I don't know really how much members of Congress, they've exempted themselves, I believe, from many laws. I don't know if the Freedom of Information Act is one of them.
I'm just wondering how complicated we're making it on ourselves in relationship to other governmental bodies, whether it's a city council and like the city of Portland, and relationships between city council members and their staff, yeah, et cetera.
Senator Shields, and I'd note again, really this particular bill does not establish the rules for what public records members were to keep. That was decided back in 1989 when they amended the public records law to make it clear it applied to members. The hole that this is addressed to is, having said you have to keep public records and not telling the members how long they have to keep them.
I understand. The part that surprised me is that that couldn't anticipate future advances in technology. Emails weren't around, literally, in 1989. And how many of us have done the wrong thing?
90. Every session.
All right, you guys. Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. You don't have any more questions?
No, Madam Chair. Just the idea that I can envision those that want to be on the safe side rather than the sorry side would start to maintain a day file, meaning January, whatever the first or second Monday of January is, would be day one. And in that day file, in addition to your bill files, et cetera, would go those things that you thought were influential, dispository, or you'd make use of, and therefore subject to the retention records, retention law. And that day file would proceed until the final day of the legislative session. But I clearly realize that I've made an error in my thinking, Madam Chair. It isn't just during the legislative session. It's 365 days of the year. So legislators are going to be required to retain on a rolling basis for 1 year documents that they may find during the legislative interims that they use to form public policy in the session. So I believe now, after hearing some of the testimony, that legislators will maintain a 365-day rolling file of information that may, in fact, be subject to the retentions law. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1062. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3465. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us what the bill does? Soon Mr. Anderson's coming up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3465 repeals a sunset, making permanent the requirement that insurers offering a health benefit plan offer coverage for emergency services without prior authorization.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I am Jim Anderson with the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, here today on House Bill 3465, and I'm proud to tell you that the issue contained in the bill earlier passed the state Senate 29 ayes, one absence, in the form of Senate Bill 617, carried by Senator Courtney. The bill, give you a little history, first of all, on the issue. This was first passed in 1997 in Senate Bill 911. And In that bill, it contained a sunset, a six-year sunset, which we addressed in 2003. The sunset was then extended with the provision and agreement through then chair of the Health Committee, Senator Fisher, and the members of the Health Insurance Association of America to meet during the interim and discuss the issue of the sunset and to eliminate the sunset. That meeting during the interim broke down for various reasons and was taken up at the beginning of this session by the group, the American Health Insurance Plans, AHIP. It was a morph of the Health Insurance Association of America. We agreed that the sunset could be eliminated, therefore there is no opposition to this bill. The reason it's before you in a House bill is when the Senate bill got to the House, the Speaker of the House had an objection with the relating clause, would not advance the bill further, so we started a new bill at that end, and you have it before you today.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Anderson? Thank you. Close the public hearing. Oops, I'm sorry. I should have asked. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3465? Seeing none, close the public hearing. House Bill 2026A. Ms. Harris, tell us about the bill. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2026A directs the Department of Administrative Services to adopt rules that standardize internal audits conducted by various state government bodies.
Sir, welcome. You must be Mr. Dunford.
George Dunford, Department of Administrative Services. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. One of the things for certain after listening to the previous discourse is what I've handed out are urgings of this committee to pass this bill out, and I presume that would be part of your record. It certainly is a public record. So it would be part of your day file.
That's correct, and it will go directly into our bill files, which it will stay until the next session.
Well, I actually hope that they are the testimony of Bob Repine, Director of Housing and Community Services, and Debbie Ferguson, who is the Director of Internal Audit at Standard Insurance Company. We previously provided testimony at the House regarding this bill. This bill, we're happy to say, passed 56-0 with no opposition. It is merely adding a management tool to your available quiver of management tools. We believe strongly that you pay for this service now, and we should provide a little more structure to it. And this bill does that.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Dunford? Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Ferguson, anything you wish to add? We lost her.
Ms. Ferguson is in Portland.
Okay.
Standards closing as
Mr. Repine.
Mr. Repine is out of town.
Okay. Mr. Jerry Kate? And Denise Tixera? Oh, it's close. I figured you either Ms. Ferguson or Ms. Did I get your last name right?
Tixera.
Okay. Thanks. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gerald Kate. I am the audit manager for Judicial, a member of the Governor's Statewide Audit Advisory Committee, and member of the local state government professional internal auditing community. Testimony offered today is not representing Judicial, but as a member of the Statewide Audit Advisory Committee, as a professional auditor, and as a volunteer member of the Institute of Internal Auditors, the North American Leadership. I have professional certifications in public accounting, internal auditing, information systems auditing, and fraud auditing and investigations. I also serve in a volunteer capacity on the Institute of Internal Auditors North American Board and have been elected to serve on their international board. Thanks for the opportunity to provide testimony here today in support of HB 2026, which should serve to strengthen internal auditing in state government. I'll be brief. The Institute of Internal Auditing recommends that states adopt legislation in order to strengthen the presence and performance of internal auditing in government. In addition to being supported by policy, rules adopted under authority of this legislation will have the force and authority of law. I'm here to support passage of House Bill 2026 and again urge its passage.
Thank you. Ms. Texera.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, I am Denise Texera, Internal Audit Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections and Chairperson for the Chief Audit Executive Council. I'm here to provide information on House Bill 2026A, which was pre-session filed by Governor Kulongoski at the request of the Department of Administrative Services to adopt rules, setting standards, policies, and procedures for internal audits conducted within the state government. The internal audit function is an integral part of executive management. It provides objective assessment of evidence and independent opinions or conclusions, builds credibility within an agency, and provides valuable advice to agency decision makers. However, there are no state laws or rules governing internal audit. The only state framework now in effect is in the Department of Administrative Services Oregon Accounting Manual Policy. This bill would provide both a framework to ensure a minimum level of competency among agency internal audit functions and a structural base so that internal audit functions can continue to add value to their agencies and to state government. It also would promote independence and objectivity in the internal audit function by creating clearer expectations. Specifically, this bill would set minimum criteria which the operations of an internal audit department is evaluated and measured, increase internal audit effectiveness, and ensure the ethical culture and independence of the internal audit function. The Department of Corrections respectfully urges that you move House Bill 2026A to full Senate with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
No.
I think you've taken care of it. Thank you. Go somewhere. Because it probably didn't get that far since we knew it had to come back. Okay, we got two ones up. Open, close public hearing on 2026, open a public hearing on 2099. Come on up, sir. Our committee administrator is flagging down committee members. So this bill authorizes the Board of Optometry to seek injunction for violation of certain statutes. Dr. Mr. Plunkett?
Okay. Chair Brown, members of the committee. This bill is fairly straightforward, and I won't take too much time. What the bill would do is to make certain changes to the board's disciplinary statute, and those things would allow the board to do an injunctive proceeding, would modify the grounds for imposition of disciplinary action, would increase the maximum amount of civil penalty, and would allow the board to assess disciplinary costs. The bill also would revise ORS 683-990 to make violation of the provisions a Class A misdemeanor that the courts could use and enforce. Most of these requested changes have been driven by recent legislation or disciplinary cases of the board and are consistent with the language already in other profession statutes. We consulted with our Assistant Attorney General on these, and these were provisions that they requested we put in our statute to help with our disciplinary tool bag. The Oregon Optometric Association supports this bill, passed the House with no dissenting votes, and I'm not aware of any opposition. I'd be happy to go into further detail or answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Plunkett. Questions? I was going to make a funny pun, but I won't, and we appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Appreciate your restraint, Madam Chair.
Just don't expect it all.
Close the public hearing on 2099. Open a public hearing on 3219. Mr. Davis. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3219A authorizes the Health Licensing Office to establish criteria for reciprocal licensure of denturists.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, sorry to keep you balls waiting.
No problem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Interest Association, United Seniors of Oregon, Oregon Association for Retired Citizens, and Gray Panthers. We urge you to support House Bill 3219. What it would do, three things. It would create an immediate reciprocal arrangement with Washington State, allowing for easier access for denturists to practice in either state, and will provide more examination opportunities for both states. The state boards of denture technology in both states are developing similar licensure examinations that will allow for prospective denturists to take the exam either here in Oregon, or they can go up to Washington State to take the examination. It will also allow for denturists licensed in Washington State to come down and practice in the state of Oregon, and vice versa for denturists in Oregon to go up and practice in Washington State, which of course they can now anyway if they want to pay the licensure fee up there. The fact is there aren't enough denturists to go around, and both states need more denturists. There is a pretty strong demand for denture services, and as the population grows, the demand grows as well. And actually, the number of denturists in the state of Oregon, licensed denturists in the state of Oregon, has actually been going down a bit over the last few years. And so this would help a lot to be able to have denturists flow freely between both states. I have been a part of working with denturists now for 30 years, and I've helped write the laws in both states, and they're pretty similar. Washington State has the ideal law because it was written after Oregon had already gone through a lot of hurdles before that. So now both laws are pretty much the same. The examinations will be the same. We just want to be able to have reciprocal agreements. There's two other areas that are covered in the bill. One of them allows for the Office of Health Licensing and the Board of Denture Technology to have the discretion to add subjects to the examination as the that reflects changes in the industry. As the industry grows and the industry continues to grow, all of healthcare is growing, and certainly denture technology is no exception. So the final area is the fact that it allows for flexibility for individuals who fail the exam. In the way the law is currently written, if an individual has a bad day and even fails a small part of the examination, maybe doesn't make, you know, the denture doesn't come together quite right, or something happens so that maybe they even pass the written and make some error on their practical. And the law as it's written now requires them to have to go out in the field for 1,000 additional hours, and that's 6 months of, you know, back out in the field. And what we want in this bill is just that for the Board of Denture Technology to have the discretion of saying, well, in the one case, this individual is getting a divorce and was having a bad day but is really a very good student and maybe needs to go out in the field for 2 months, another one might need 6 months, another one 4 months, but the Board of Denture Technology should be able to make that decision. These are usually older workers who become denturists, and they have families and they have lives and they need to make a living. So we just wanted to be fair with that. We have also given you, we've given you...
I have the fact that the Oregon Dental Association is a neutral on the bill.
Yes, they are. We are happy to say that.
Does that mean they don't care, they're fine with it, or they don't want to get involved?
Actually, I'm glad you asked that, Madam Chair. I'm glad you asked that question. Normally, we have had tendencies in the past to butt heads on this topic with the Oregon Dental Association. But in this particular instance, they asked for a certain amendment to the bill on the House side, which actually put into the bill language around that clarified that anybody who was asking for reciprocity would have had to have had at least 3,500 hours of experience in the field over a 5-year period. And they wanted that language in. We were very very comfortable with that. They wanted other language in that said, up in line 14 on the first page, a written and practical examination, which was certainly just an oversight in terms of language. And at that point, they removed their opposition and became neutral. So we have no opposition to the bill now, and we're very pleased with that. We appreciated their cooperation.
Mr. Davis, I'm assuming dentists are opposed to fluoride since...
The dentures have not taken a stand on the fluoride issue.
Okay. All right. Any other questions for Mr. Davis?
If I might just add that I've given you testimony from the chair of the Board of Denture Technology and the number of hours required to become a denturist. I've got testimony from the Office of Health Licensing for the state who's supporting this, and their testimony is there. So I think everything is together and ready. Hopefully you will send this to the floor with a due pass.
Thank you. Questions?
I think you wowed us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3219. Okay, I'm going to move into work session on a number of bills that we've heard today, and I'll just take them one by one. The first bill on our agenda is House Bill 2207. Legislative Council found a statutory conflict between House Bill 2207, which passed out of our committee last week, and another bill. Senator Farrielli.
Did we have the vote counts from the action we took last week? I don't seem to have one in a bill file. Mm. And how the committee acted last week.
If you're willing to give me just a moment. Let's give Ms. Harris a minute, and I'll move on to the next bill. Basically, we have a rectifying amendment to get rid of the conflict. Proponents of the bill have reviewed the amendment, and they're okay. So we're going to need to move to suspend the committee rules and reconsider the vote. Ms. Harris will check out vote numbers. Is she already? It takes a minute. Okay, it's coming. On that one. Chair would like to move House Bill 2, open a work session on House Bill 2999. The bill increases from 12 to 16, the maximum number of children allowed to be cared for in a certified family child care home. I know there were issues about that this would make child care workers' job harder and the care the children got not as good. I think the opposite is in fact true. It actually makes it more financially feasible to hire more child care workers. And dear Lord, I really commend the child care workers that have 16 children in their home. Mm-hmm. Chair would move House Bill 2999 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Who'd like to carry this bill? Senator Shields, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lingo.
I just find this testimony unbelievable. I can watch 10 2- to 5-year-old children by myself.
I find that very scary, Senator Lingo, that anybody would let you watch any more than 2 children by yourself.
That's not my testimony.
Open a work session on House Bill 3017, Mr. Broadfoot's bill regarding removing the 6-month requirement. Any questions? The chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions? Any objections? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Senator Farrielli, do you wish to carry?
Not particularly, Madam Chair,
okay.
But I will if you so desire.
Okay. Senator Ringo, do you want to carry?
Yes.
Okay. We have a willing carrier. You're off the hook. So I have very early on this one anyway. Chair would open a work session on House Bill 3465, repeals the sunset on law mandating health insurance coverage of emergency services. Any discussion? Any questions? Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. Would you like to carry that one?
Madam, if Chair, if you desire.
Okay. Senator Farrielli gets to carry House Bill 3465. Chair would open a work session on 2026, directs our Oregon DAS to adopt rules setting standards, policies, and procedures for internal audits. This is government regulating itself. Any discussion? Any concerns about the bill? Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection?
Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. I'll carry that one.
Madam Chair.
2026.
Could you regress just a moment?
Sure.
Conference. What was the bill you just moved?
I'm sorry. 2026. DAS providing for internal.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank
you, ma'am.
All right. Okay. I just received a note from Ms. Myers. All right, we'll move into work session on House Bill 2099. It allows the Board of Optometry to seek injunctions for violation of certain statutes. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? And seeing none, so ordered. Who wants to make themselves a friend of the optometrist today? Sarah Shields, thanks for volunteering. We appreciate your willingness to work so hard.
Aye, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Chair opens a work session on House Bill 321A. Just received a note from Ms. Myers, who represents the Oregon Dental Association. They are okay with House Bill 3219, making sure dentists that meet certain requirements can get reciprocal licensing. Any discussion? Chair would move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Senator Ringo, since you're opposing the fluoride bill, can I get you to carry that bill?
I'm not opposing the fluoride
okay.
bill.
Okay. Great. That's good to know. Makes the dentist very happy. Would you still carry the Venturist bill? Thank you very much.
I'm happy to.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I've received lots of communications from dentists saying that even though it would harm their business, they do support fluoride.
All right.
So just
okay, just to clarify for the record. 1062, we will not move today. We'll wait until Senator Atkinson is here. Senate Bill 1054. Chair would move into work session on Senate Bill 1054, increases the members of the emergency ward. We have the -1 amendments, which you all should have in front of you. Ms. Harris, when do you want to go through the amendments for us? I can't find. Oh, here it is. I got mine. Okay. 3, 8, and 9, and then 3, 4, and 5. So would this make the total on the emergency board?
22 members.
22. So it would be 11 and 11 on each side.
Correct.
That's too many, Madam Chair.
Okay.
9 and 9.
Your Senate President would ask you to move this bill.
I am glad to oblige.
Thank you very
Madam
much.
Chairman, why don't we have the Senate President trot up here?
Because, you know, I don't think he needs the exercise this afternoon. Chair would move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 1054.
With objection, Madam Chair.
Okay. Objection from Senator Farioli. Why don't you just call the roll to the amendments? Thank you.
Senator Ringo.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli.
I object.
Chair Brown.
Chair votes
aye. Motion carries. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Please. What I'm saying?
As amended.
As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Farioli votes no. Senator Atkinson is excused. Any further objections? Hearing seen none, so ordered. Senator Courtney will carry that bill. Let's move lastly to House Bill 2207. Vote count, do we have one? Oh, yes.
Madam Chair, the vote count was provided without objection.
Okay.
4-0 and 1 was absent.
Okay.
So there were no objections to the original.
All right. Statutory conflict between 2207 and another bill. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2207. The chair would move to suspend the committee rules and reconsider the committee's vote on House Bill 2207. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would then move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2207. It is in front of you. It's simply a conflict amendment. Any discussions on the -1 amendments? Okay, Chair has moved the -1 amendments. Any objection to the -1 amendments? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. The Chair would move House Bill 2207 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Again?
Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, is so ordered, and I'll continue to carry the bill. With that, we will carry over Senate Bill 1062 until Thursday. We're not meeting Thursday till tomorrow. We can carry it over to tomorrow, right? We'll carry it over tomorrow. Hopefully Senator Atkinson will be back in action. If not, we'll continue to set it over. House Bill 3151, we will all continue to stew about. Any further business to come before the committee?
Well, they don't need stew, just any kind of food.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Shields. With that, we're adjourned.
Why are we meeting on Thursday?
Because...